Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 338 of the podcast. It's Friday, 8th of September, 2017, as I record this, back in a very rainy Bath after a brief holiday walking in the Dolomite Mountains of northern Italy. So today I'm talking with Michael Ridpath, who started his career in financial thrillers before moving into crime, and who started out with a very big publishing deal back in the good old days and is now experimenting with hybrid publishing. And Michael has a great perspective on the pros and cons of both sides of the publishing spectrum, as well as what's changed. And he's also one of the authors I've met at British literary events over the years who has always been lovely and friendly. Friendly and never judged me for being indie. So I really enjoyed our chat and hope you do too. In publishing news this week, very exciting, Kobo has just announced the move into audiobooks, both for direct sale and for a monthly subscription. And you can find out more at kobo.com/audiobooks. Now, this has been in the works for a while, and it's very exciting to finally see it happening. If you are on Findaway Voices with Drafter Digital or Author Republic or one of the other distributors, your book might be appearing on the site, and hopefully there will be a Kobo Writing Life direct upload coming in the future. But this is early days, but great to see audiobooks moving onto Kobo. And I think it also fits how podcast listeners in particular want to consume content. I certainly listen to a lot more audiobooks these days. And I think it's only, you know, it is a growth industry, absolutely. And all the statistics say it is. So good on Kobo for getting involved in that. The Successful Author Mindset is available on Kobo as an audiobook. I published that through Authors Republic. And so that is available there. And I will be slowly sorting out my other non-fiction, but that is available. My fiction is currently exclusive with ACX, as I've mainly done royalty split deals, but over time that will phase out. So I'm looking forward to the ecosystem really expanding for audio. And more value add from distributors as Drafter Digital introduces professional quality ebook templates. So, you know, if you are not into using Vellum, as I am, for doing your design, you can use a free design from Drafter Digital. And this is amazing. I think what we're seeing more and more is, you know, an expansion of offerings from the distributors in order to tempt authors over to use them for distribution. You know, authors can get attractive EPUB and MOBI files if they work through Drafter Digital, and they can get a print-ready PDF to use with print on demand, such as CreateSpace and Ingram Spark, all for free. So this is incredible. I also think, and it's interesting, Jim and Brian have talked about this on the Selmore Book Show, is the sort of the downward pressure on the ecosystem of prices that lead us to create these ebooks. So, I mean, you can get your formatting for free, as we've just said. You don't need to pay for formatting. Now, I really do love Vellum for doing my design, my ebook design, certainly, although I have actually asked them for more print templates for their print outputs. But as technology gets better, we will continue to get even better services. Now, this doesn't help with the process of creating the work in the first place. I still think, you know, that's not going to change, although I am looking forward to working together with my AI assistant when that eventually happens, and it will. But yeah, really interesting how that's changing. Also, in keeping with the topic of my chat with Michael Ridpath, Christine Catherine Rush has just posted an article about Rip Van Winkle syndrome on chriswrites.com, K-R-I-S-Writes.com. And of course, I always enjoy Chris's posts. And what she's basically talking about, the how traditional publishing has changed, and in the same way as Michael and I talk about. And she says, quote, "What I didn't foresee and should have was that traditional publishers would cut so many major bestsellers from their lists. Writers who made lots of money for the company had sales decline just like everyone else. These writers were making consistent six-figure incomes, not seven-figure." And basically, you know, people who are considered decent earners are being let go from traditional publishing. And she says, some have savings, some don't, but many are going from making a hell of a living from their writing to making nothing. And this is interesting because I mentioned this after the Thriller Fest conference, that people were coming up to me, people I thought were doing well, saying, you know, basically they're not making any money, or they're you know, their income has like gone to a quarter of what it used to be. And, you know, these people are looking at, you know, they're popping their heads out of the sand, looking around and seeing that indie writers are making money. And the traditional folks who are joining us out of necessity are where the rest of us were in 2009 to 2012. So this is really interesting. This is kind of a metaphor, the Rip Van Winkle sort of waking up after years of sleep and kind of going, oh, things have changed. And it's interesting from a couple of perspectives. First of all, if you are interested in traditional publishing, and I know a lot of indies still are, or and I know I have so many friends who are traditionally published, and what's so interesting is how many of them are changing their names, because it's better to be a debut in this new market and roll the roulette wheel on your debut hitting big and being, of course, a girl on the train or something like that. If you're mid-list, you know, these authors who've got maybe 10 books, 6 to 10 books, who, you know, were doing well, are being encouraged by their agents to use a different name and try for a new debut deal, because publishers are kind of doing this roulette wheel. They've got the big names and then they've got the debuts, and then in the middle is being squeezed. So if you're mid-list and you want to keep your name, then it's better to be indie, because our business model is not based on the spike, you know, the spike income model. It's based on a growing sort of monthly income that is consistent over time. And that's certainly where I am. You know, my income from publishing is not a massive spike every month, but it's pretty consistent across the year, so that over a year I make, you know, a very good living, but from what many traditionally published authors who have massive debuts would consider not very good. So it's a very different business model. Secondly, obviously there will be more and more mid-list traditionally published authors joining the indie world, some of whom with a big backlist. So that's interesting. And, you know, I think that's definitely starting to happen. Many of them are not talking about it, but, you know, in public, but are in the forums and things. Also, about things changing. So, you know, when I started self-publishing back in the day, I'm so old now, you know, back in 2007, 2008, when I was publishing before the Kindle, you know, before the international Kindle, things were very different. And the mistakes I made then are mistakes that hopefully you wouldn't make now, because things are so different. But also, don't expect the status quo to last. And let's not be authors with Rip Van Winkle syndrome in a few years' time. So, you know, people moan about, oh, you know, the KU payout has gone down, or, oh, you know, these types of ads are working and now they're not working because there's so many people involved. And, you know, I think I've been looking at streaming. I'm going to talk a bit more about this when I do a futurist show, but, you know, how the move, the trend towards streaming, monthly payments for unlimited content, this is not going away. This is only going to grow. And Kobo, with their audio offering, are kind of proving that as well. At Kobo Plus in the Netherlands, KU is not the only game in town for monthly payments for unlimited, or, you know, specific content like audio. You know, I think micropayments will be facilitated by blockchain technologies. I think as the internet moves further into the emerging markets, we're going to see, you know, authors making more and more micropayments because of currency exchange. And also secondhand ebooks, I think, are going to be a thing. I think this is a very fast moving world. We can't expect the status quo to last. So, you know, it's really about making sure if you are making some money from the current market, then it's putting some of that away so that if things change, you're not left high and dry. You know, I again, reminded of a friend, an author friend who, you know, was considering getting a day job again after 10 years of being a writer. And, you know, it begs the question, well, what are we actually, you know, at this point, I've been out of my, what I used to do for 6 years. I can't do that again. You know, if I needed to get a day job, I would have to do something in publishing probably, or marketing or something like that. But it's interesting to consider how things change over time. And we can't expect things to stay the same. So, yeah. So there's no point lamenting the change. You just have to stay up to date. And of course, my intent is always to be here to help you on the way. Now, I say always. I can't guarantee always. I'll certainly be here for the next year or two. you know, as my husband says, I'm actually a change junkie. I love change and I enjoy it. So if things aren't changing, I get really antsy and I'm like, okay, what can we do? What do I need to do? Move countries or move house or, you know, change up what I'm doing. So I hope to be here to help you on the way as things do change. So my personal update, I had a wonderful 3 days walking in the Dolomites. It was gorgeous weather, amazing scenery, really stunning place, quite unusual because it's Northern Italy, but, you know, legally it's Northern Italy, but it's the Sud Tyrol, which is Southern Austria. And in fact, it was Austrian until the First World War. And most people speak German. It's a very, very Austrian area. So quite weird because I've been to a lot of Italy, but never that area. And it's definitely doesn't feel Italian. It feels Austrian and a very beautiful area. Highly recommended if you enjoy walking and biking and just cross-country skiing and all kinds of things. And of course, walking longer distances, and these were quite, you know, big days walking, especially up mountains, gives you a real perspective on life, because mostly you care about breathing when you're walking uphill, and you can't think about much when you're concentrating on breathing. And also water, food, shelter when the storm comes, and sleep. So the important stuff that really, I think, brings everything back to a perspective. Help really helps me, because we can all get obsessed with social media and comparisonitis and book sales and are we doing enough? And, you know, there's so many things, but if you just get back to basics, it can really help. So we had a brilliant few days and it was meant to be a whole week, but we were hit by the group, in fact, because it was a small group tour. You know, we were hit by the Australian mega flu. If you Google Australian flu, you will see it's one of the worst flus ever in Australia. And one of the ladies in the group came over from Sydney, and yeah, it makes me want to write a pandemic thriller, because it's, you think you're superhuman, right? You think you're strong and you can do anything. Well, sometimes well, I do most of the time. I'm like, yeah, I'm, you know, and I've got energy and I'm good to go, and then some tiny little microbial flu thing, excuse any biologists listening, but, you know, comes along and essentially wipes you out completely, and you realise that you're not, you know, that you really could just be wiped out very easily by something you can't even see. And again, perspective, it really is interesting. So I had thought that I would be thinking a lot about my business and, you know, reading a lot of intelligent books and, you know, catching up on a lot of the things I wanted to catch up on. But actually ended up just, you know, lying in bed a lot and coughing, thinking about breathing again. And, you know, watching, we watched a lot of TV. We binge watched the whole of Game of Thrones one day because we couldn't do much else. But the time out from the day-to-day business has been great, but it's so interesting how your brain one day can just be working really well and then it just doesn't work. So yeah, it's been a real humbling couple of weeks for me, and sometimes that's what we need. So I'm trying to look for the silver lining in the flu experience. I've actually only had flu twice now, like proper flu twice in my life. This was the second time, and yeah, proper flu really isn't a cold. It really isn't. I'm hoping the silver lining is that now I've had this flu, that I won't get it again when it hits the Northern Hemisphere winter, which inevitably it will, because we are a global world and people jumping on planes. And in fact, by coming back to Bath, Jonathan and I have probably, brought it to Bath. But yeah, there you go. So watch out for the flu this winter, everybody. One of the things that did strike me while I was away was that we can get caught up in our little author ghetto and forget that the rest of the world doesn't know what we know. So, you know, as you do on these trips, you talk about what you do, and everyone else on the group did what would be considered normal jobs. And one guy could not get into his head how I made a living. He just couldn't get it. It was kind of fascinating to watch him ask me over and over again, like, how do you make a living online? How do you not have a publisher? How do you not have an office or employees? And how do you do that? And his realization and his reaction to what I do made me realize that most people don't understand what we do. Most people are still wrestling with the idea of writing a book, let alone the possibilities of digital publishing, marketing, and making a living online. So pat yourself on the back if you understand even a tiny percentage of what's going on in our little space, because you know far more than you think you do, just by listening to this show and others in the niche and reading some books and giving it a go. You know far more than 99.99999% of the planet. And in fact, if you compare yourself with other authors, you probably know a ton more. So you are further along than perhaps you think. And that was encouraging to me, because sometimes I feel like I'm behind. So yeah, I hope that helps you a little bit. Now, you might be able to hear the rain now. It really is hammering down here in Bath, and I'm actually recording this in my cupboard now. I've adopted the recording podcasts in the cupboard because Jonathan, my husband, is in the study. So I'm in the cupboard today. It's actually quite nice and cozy. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments on the podcasts and things. Alana says, I listen to your podcast in rural Alaska. We're talking so rural, we have to haul our own water. I take you along with me when I feed our chickens, which is really cool, Alana, because you're hauling your own water and feeding the chickens, but you're listening to a podcast over the internet. So I think what's interesting now is what we used to consider rural might be rural in one way, but if you have the internet, you can have your global online business, which is cool. S.A. Holland says, prepping for Hurricane Irma and listening to the podcasts. Stay safe, S.A., and everyone who is suffering with the violent weather around the world. Yeah, again, don't take any risks with your breathing. That's my message this week. Doug Salter on the interview with Brian. I bought Brian's book and went through a month-long learning process using it. Brian knows what he's talking about. Amazon marketing services or Amazon ads is not for the weak. And I definitely agree with that. Joanne Mallory says, lovely to hear you and Sarah Painter talking about writer's problems. So glad we're all weird together, and that we are. Claire Nightingale says, hidden artworks in the necropolis make for a lovely afternoon walk in sunny Sydney, and sent a lovely picture of a graveyard with a big sugar skull in, which looked very cool. And watch out for the flu bug over there, Claire. And Aubrey Spivey, listening to the podcast while hiding from 80,000 odd people at Dragon Con, introvert time. And that's classic, because when I went to Frankfurt Book Fair, which is one of the, you know, biggest publishing industry things, I essentially just went and hid in the Chinese section. I literally went and sat in the Chinese section where everybody ignored me, and it was much quieter, and because I was so overwhelmed and it was a nightmare. So there we go, introverts hiding at conventions. I'm with you. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kovo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from them in a minute. And of course, just to reiterate, Kobo now has audiobooks, kobo.com/audiobooks, which is very exciting. So this corporate sponsorship, pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is sponsored by you guys and everyone supporting the show on Patreon. And of course, I really appreciate your Patreon support. It does mean so much to me. Thanks to all the existing patrons, and thanks to new patrons, Lisa King, Kim Romana, Lon Varnador, Anya Carolina Christensen, Chrissy Whistler, Lisa B. Thomas, Tina Collins, and Susan Becker. Thank you so much, everybody. And I really love the Patreon support. It just means so much to me. It really does. I think that the patron money is like that Thousand True Fans idea. So thank you so much. And if you would like to support the show on Patreon, you can even support just a couple of dollars a month, less than a coffee a month, or you can throw in a couple of coffees if you like, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording in the next week or so. So please add your questions on the form if you're a Patreon supporter, and you'll get that extra audio. And of course, there's tons of Q&As that you can download if you become a Patreon supporter. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, here's a word from Kobo, and then we'll get into the interview.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Lefebvre, director of Kobo Writing Life. I'm here to tell you about some of the great things that the Promotions tab, which is still in beta release through Kobo Writing Life, can do for you as an author. Now, even though it's still in beta release, because we're still in the process of optimizing it and refining it, you can request to have the Promotions tab added to your account by emailing us at writinglife@kobo.com. The most popular and most successful promotions we run are typically the monthly 30% off promos. Sometimes they're themes. Sometimes we're looking only for books of a certain price point or box sets or in different genres. We also have the free page, landing page hooks are actually also really, really popular. To check out more about things that work for Kobo authors selling on Kobo, you can check out KoboWritingLife.com, where we have articles on the craft and business of writing. But let's get back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Today, I'm here with Michael Ridpath. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Joanna.
Great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Michael is the international best-selling author of 16 novels that range from financial thrillers through Icelandic crime thrillers, historical spy novels, and most recently, Amnesia, which incorporates aspects of thriller, crime, and history. So all in one, which sounds very cool, Michael. That's you. That's your most recent one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it came out in May, so just out.
Just out, exactly, as we talk. So I want to talk to you today. So your story is so interesting. So you, back in 1995, you left the City of London as a bond trader, which is just, you know, it's too exciting, really, to become a full-time author with your first financial thriller. So take us back. 1995, you seriously left what must have been an incredibly high-earning job to become an author. And now everyone's going, what is he doing? So what made you leave your job to become a writer, and what was the publishing industry like back then?
Well, I started writing the book as a hobby, so it wasn't a career decision at all. And I was a bond trader, and I decided I would write a novel about being a bond trader. So after sort of three goes of writing and rewriting the same book over 3 years, I sent it out to a set of agents, and they sent it round a number of publishers, and I got a very good advance for my first novel, a completely surprising one. I think it was a record at the time, which is a bit of a shock, and was a shock to my colleagues when they read about it in the newspaper too. So I had an opportunity to give up work and do what I found I really enjoyed doing, which was writing, and earn a decent amount of money doing it. So that's what I did. I gave up in, I think, 1995, which is when my first book, Free to Trade, came out. And to answer your question about what was the publishing world like then, it was very different. It was very hard to get into, but once you were in, and I was very lucky, and you were published by a big publisher, then you could earn a serious amount of money, because what was called the net book agreement was still around, which meant that books were still full priced in this country, and importantly in other countries as well, including America. So there was a lot more money to go around. There was a lot more profit in the system. And the author had a lot more power. So if you were fortunate to have a good publisher and be writing in a fashionable genre, then you could make very good money. The other thing that was good was once you were established, you sort of started off with an inch on the shelf at W.H. Smith, and then it got wider and wider and wider, or it did in theory. And, you know, you eventually take over the whole shelf. So things started out well for me and for financial thrillers.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. There's a few things there. I mean, the netbook agreement, we're fast forwarding to now. Let's go back. So 1995 was kind of the beginnings of the internet, right? And yeah. I wanted to ask, because we're going to come later to how you're doing book marketing now. But in 1995, what were you doing for that first novel? What did you do for book marketing?
For book marketing, it was book tours. So I went on book tours all over the world. And that would involve a publicity person setting up lots of interviews and book signings. So basically, the good things would be an interview with a national newspaper or a TV program. But you'd be filled in with lots of local radio interviews and lots of book signings where you go to a bookshop, you wait an hour, three people show up, and then you deface their book. And that has obviously changed dramatically in the last 20 years. My second book, Trading Reality, was actually about a virtual reality company. And my US publisher, HarperCollins, got in touch with me to say I needed a website. And I thought, that's ridiculous. How can I get a website? But they said, you know, all high-tech authors in the States had a website. So I made up my own website on CompuServe. And I think it was, you know, one of the first UK authors to do it, which was interesting.
Wow, that's so cool. And of course, VR back in the late 90s, I guess it was, it seems funny because then it all disappeared, didn't it? That was meant to be VR and then it all disappeared. Yeah. And now it's all coming back again.
Yeah, in almost exactly the same. That is really strange because everything else has changed hugely in the last 20 years, but virtual reality, hardly at all. It's still the technology of tomorrow.
Yeah, what was that?
Maybe this time really will be.
What was that second book called? I'm really interested in that one.
It was called Trading Reality. About a virtual reality startup. So it was sort of a financial thriller, but a lot of it was about, I had invested in a virtual reality company myself whilst working in the city. And it was an interesting subject to write about and probably still is.
Oh, yeah, wow. You're going to have to reboot that. Trading Reality 2 or something. Yeah. That would be fantastic because, of course, now like companies like Magic Leap, that are so secretive and you wonder what the hell's going on there and they're just going to burst out and it's going to be cool. But so you built your site on CompuServe. Now, presumably, because, of course, bond trading and, you know, it used to be in finance that you did a lot of things yourself on a computer and now it's all kind of done. So you were probably quite techy compared to a lot of authors.
I was techie then, yeah. And then the rest of the world has caught up and overtaken me. But I did know a lot about spreadsheets at a very tender age.
I think that's actually an advantage. And as we come later, like some of the things you're embracing for book marketing, there's a lot of authors of your standard and caliber in Britain who are not. I think that's really cool. So moving forward, you did 8 financial thrillers, but then in 2006, you started to write different genres. So what changed? Why make the decision to shift? Because I see from your book reviews that your readers still want more financial thrillers.
Yeah, it's interesting. Things started to go wrong. Financial thrillers were supposed to be the new legal thriller. Mm. And that was why they sort of signed me up as the English John Grisham. And it never really worked out like that, unfortunately. It did pretty well, but it turned out to be quite a small niche. And I found my main readers weren't people who were actually working in banking, but their mothers. So these, you know, the great readers for all of us, these women in their 50s and 60s who had kids and working in the city or on Wall Street like to read my books to find out what it's all about. So that was fine with me. But what happened was my sales were declining. Legal thrillers were declining. Financial thrillers were declining. And I was dropped by Penguin, who were my publishers. Mm. And that happened to a number of people at that time. I mean, Mark Dawson, who's a famous self-published author, was one of them at almost the same time. And when that happens, you can do two things. You can either try and figure out who else is going to publish your financial thrillers, or you can sort of think, okay, the world's changing. I've got to change with it. But then what was extremely difficult was changing genres, because although editors might like the new book I wrote, I started writing a series about Iceland. Although editors might like it, the sales and marketing people would always say, Michael Ridpath is a brand in financial thrillers. Mm. You know, we can't rebrand him. Forget it. So that was the trouble I had in changing genres. That's something which is much easier to do now, both for me and I think everybody else. But it was really hard sort of 10, 15 years ago.
That's really interesting. So what was the, because of course a lot of this does happen to a lot of people. This is not unusual.
I mean, it does.
Many authors think, oh, I've got a book deal. That's it. You know, I'm going to stay with the same publisher, the same agent, the same everything. Do you know any authors who've been in the game 20 years who have the same agent, the same publisher, like, and getting the same money?
Yes, but they are nearly all older than me. So they'd be in their 60s or 70s. So someone like Ken Follett, you know, people who were well established about the time I was coming on. And I started about the same time as Lee Child, and he would obviously be one too. Mm. So I didn't quite make it, but I think anyone who started maybe a few years after I did, it does get harder as time goes on. And what happens for a lot of people is your series runs its course. And of course, you think it will carry on forever, and so do your publishers. But in practice, you know, maybe it's 4 books, maybe it's 10 books, maybe it's 15 books, but eventually you or they want you to do something else. And then the writers kind of split into two, those who are willing and prepared to do something else and those who aren't. Mm. I think the good thing I did back in 2006, although it was a blow to be dropped by Penguin, who are a very good publisher, was I thought, well, I'm only going to succeed in this if I look ahead to the next thing rather than defending what's happened in the past. And I think in general now, the secret to success for authors and also especially publishers is those who are looking ahead to figure out what's coming next rather than to defend what's a sort of declining market.
Wow. I've got so many questions coming out from that. But I think one there, you said about, you know, kind of moving on and looking forward, that mindset of pivoting, which you did when you changed genres. I mean, you could have just gone, oh, well, I guess I'll go get a job again or something, which you see with a lot of authors, actually. What was that mindset shift for you that kept you writing as opposed to, in quotation marks, giving up? Because, of course, lots of people choose not to write, but you chose to carry on.
Well, there's two things. First of all, I absolutely love it, and I think I'm still learning a lot. I think Amnesia is my best book, so and I think I still have a lot to learn. So I wanted to carry on doing that. Also, I quite like the challenge of, the financial thriller world is a very niche one. I was like a big fish or a medium-sized fish in an extremely small pool. Mm. I quite like the idea of sort of taking on the big boys and girls and writing in a broader genre. So crime or thrillers, both of which I did, seemed a bit more of a challenge. And I think when you start off writing about what you know, which is probably a good thing to do, but after you've written several books about what you know, you quite like the idea of writing about what you don't know. So those sort of the sort of personal reason for writing factors definitely push me towards trying something else. And then there's a sort of commercial thing, which usually it's best if you can make the commercial dovetail in what you want to do, because then you do it better and more profitably. So that's what I did, I think.
That's great. And yeah, I totally agree with that. And the second thing I had here is you've mentioned when the series has run its course. And that's actually a really good comment. Now, and what's funny right now is Game of Thrones. So, you know, Game of Thrones TV series is awesome, has now overtaken the books. And like the series really, even though people want more, it feels like it's run its course. So how did you, and I feel this with one of my series. And so how do you know when a series has run its course in terms of your own sense, rather than just it's not making so much money?
I suspect. I mean, it's beginning to happen with my financial thrillers when planning the next book seems a little bit of a chore because you're reworking previous themes. So in my Magnus books, which are about Iceland, I get really excited when I go back to Iceland because, you know, I love the country and I've got more to write about. Maybe eventually I'll sort of think, well, Magnus has done this before, but he should probably do it again because I need to come up with a book. Mm-hmm. So I have never really got to that point myself. It was my publisher who thought the financial thrillers had run out of steam, but I think that's what it is. Mm-hmm. What I did find is writing, if you can switch from writing a series book to writing either a standalone or another series, that sort of refreshes you. So coming back to the familiar security of a series is a good thing rather than, oh, my God, I've got to write another the same book yet again. So I think that's from a creative point of view, that's a good thing to do. So do one or two books in a series, then switch and then go back to it. And I think that will give it more legs. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I agree. I feel that way. That's how I'm kind of doing it. But what's funny is my standalones just don't sell as well because, you know, they don't have a built-in market.
Yes.
So then you're like, oh, well, I should just go back and do another one of those. And but it is a very interesting sort of balance. But something else you said, your publisher had said something like Michael Ridpath is a brand. And yes. I've got, in Britain, this is not just a British thing, but right now, a whole load of people that you and I know are using different names to like relaunch as a debut. Or I saw on your Twitter stream, you know, maybe I should be Michelle because, you know, men are using women's names and I'm used JF Penn because having a female name sold worse in action adventure. So what do you think is going on with, is it just because the publishing industry can only make money from debuts or big names? Or, you know, what is it? Is this just marketing?
Well, my own experience, which I suppose is 10 years ago, when I was making the switch, I had the problem with, I started off with the spy novels, actually, and they were turned down because of my name. So then I wrote the Icelandic novels and submitted those under a pseudonym. But then, so they got through the sales and marketing thing. But when the editor found out who I was, he said, oh, that's great. You know, let's go ahead with it. So then I switched back to my own name. And then I did the same thing again for the spy novels, which has failed first time. I sent it all out again under a pseudonym and that got published again. So in my case, the problem was this brand thing as far as publishers were concerned. Mm. I have a feeling though, it's very different for self-published authors. Because the whole point about self-publishing is everything you do is cumulative. Every reader you've got who likes your books might buy another one. And once you start changing your name, you're losing all your old readers. So I think I would stick, I mean, you know, obviously more about self-publishing than I do, but I think I would stick with the brand once you've got it and then try and build on it. And you'll take some of your readers with you and some not. But changing, I mean, throwing away all your old readers, if you've got quite a few, is probably not a good idea unless you absolutely have to.
Yeah, it feels to me like the sort of, well, let's just try and do another Girl on the Train, you know, because Paula Hawkins, that was a new name for an existing author. And it's like, oh, well, let's have another go at a debut. But you're right. And another reason for self-publishers is the Amazon algorithms and, you know, iTunes and all of that, iBooks, all run on machine learning. And if you have a brand name already, there's people who've bought your books, they're going to actually recommend your books to those people. Yes. So I just think it's crazy.
In the publishing world, it works the other way because as soon as the other thing that happened in the late 1990s was booksellers would look at BookScan. So if you were coming up with a book, they would look at your name and then they'd look at your previous sales. Mm. And that would be the main reason for whether they ordered your books again. Penguin had a warehouse problem in the early 2000s, which meant my sales and my backlist fell to almost zero. And then that meant very few people were reordering. Of course, you don't get that in the self-publishing world. People don't care too much what the sales of your previous book were. If they're a reader trying to buy it, you know, if they've read it before, that's great. Or if someone else has recommended it, that's great. So that great hindrance has gone. I mean, it's interesting now. There are a lot of people make a lot of money in the self-publishing world, but in the published world, there are lots of debut authors who are making six figures with their first book in a way that I never could, because of this phenomenon of having a new name.
But then they seem to be the second book, they don't, and then by the third book they're dropped, and then the fourth book they're told to use another name again.
Yeah, that can happen. I mean, anything can happen.
It's kind of, I know a few people right now who this is happening to, and I'm kind of just gobsmacked about it. And then I can see why, because as you said, like your name was associated with a certain genre, so that's what readers think. I don't know, I almost want to say that readers are more intelligent, not intelligent now, but are used to a broader range of things happening, maybe.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, when I talked to my publisher about a standalone a couple of years ago, I was worried they'd say no. But actually, they were very keen, which is a definite change from 10 years ago. So I think publishers are more – my publisher, Atlantic, is I think, quite sort of forward-looking. I think they're more savvy than they used to be about being, you know, authors being locked in one particular brand.
Oh, that's interesting. Right. So kind of, you know, moving up to today with your publishing choices and kind of part of the reason I invited you on the show is that you, you're embracing the hybrid model now. So maybe talk about what's happening now with how you're publishing and why you've chosen these things.
Well, it's interesting. The, there is still, I think, a huge divide between self-published and traditionally published authors. And a lot of traditionally published authors don't ignore self-published authors. And some self-published authors kind of slag off traditional publishers as being unimaginative. And, you know, all that's sort of partly true. But it seemed to me that self-published authors were doing a lot of things that were working. And I remember when I first met you, I thought, you know, that sounds interesting. And the more I found out about it, the more interested I came, and as did my agent. So it seems that a lot of my books are sold on Kindle because the kind of commercial fiction I buy, I write is going to be bought on Kindle, either traditionally or self-published. I've always been published badly in America for no really good reason. So it seemed to me that since I got a British publisher I'm very happy with and not really any good American publishers, then there was an opportunity to try and do both. And so my plan is to try and publish, self-publish in America and be traditionally published in Britain, and then hopefully get books translated everywhere else through traditional publishers. Whether that will work, I don't know. I mean, what I found is that my financial thrillers are all self-published now. The rights reverted to me. And from sales declining to nothing in the last 2 or 3 years, I've got them up to a reasonably good figure for books that are at least 10 years old. But they do tend to do better in the UK than the US. So I haven't quite worked out how to break into the US properly through self-publishing. But, you know, there's plenty to learn and plenty of time to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's it. And it's great you've got the rights back. One little tip, box sets.
Right. Yeah, I tried one of those and it really didn't work. I tried a box set of financial thrillers. Maybe I did it wrong. But yeah, I don't know why it didn't work, but it didn't.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to take on the challenge and have a look at your look at your books. But so you mentioned Britain and the US. What about the rest of the English speaking world? Because are you going to put the books up, you know, Canada, Australia, everywhere else?
Yeah, I've always done one in Australia. But my British publisher has those rights for Canada and the rest of the English-speaking world, and they do a pretty good job. I mean, I think the other thing, it might be related to self-publishing in the past. I always made most of my money through foreign translations. So through the financial thrillers, I probably made over half my money from foreign translations. When I did this Fire and Ice series, it started off with probably 90% of my income coming from foreign translations. So, and then that trailed off in the last few years. So my, you know, the real blow I've had in the last 5 years or since the crash has been lack of foreign translations. But I think that although it's less of an opportunity it used to be for English speaking authors, I think it is an opportunity. And I know you've been doing some work on how to get books translated in the self-published world, but it seems to me that an international writer writing international books should be making at least half of his or her income from translations one way or another. And we sort of all need to figure out how to do that through the self-published world. Which world has this sort of very efficient mechanism for doing it.
Yeah, to be honest on that, since you're a futurist as well, I tried doing it. It's very hard, mainly because of the marketing. So if you self-publish in foreign languages, the marketing is just impossible. So I've pulled back on that and I'm licensing rights as well.
Yeah,
But I actually think, in the last couple of years, they've developed these language translation AIs. I think this is going to be a massive disruption in the translation market. I think we won't need translation within, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. With universal translation, you'll be able to read on the Kindle and just pick up a book in Mandarin or whatever and read it in English. Or you and I can be talking, you know, there's already one on Skype. You can talk in different languages. Yeah. So I think there's a disruption coming there, which is crazy. Yeah. Who knows? But you heard it here first. So coming back to, you and I, as you said, we met a number of years ago now, and I've been, you know, you've always been really friendly and lovely. And to me, that's actually been great. And thank you for that, because I felt very
ostracized in the British publishing community, even though, you know, I tried to be part of it. So what do you think has, or has it changed? Like, I think, again, I think you're quite forward thinking, which is why you were interested. But do you think it had, the attitude has changed or is changing, or is it swinging the other way almost?
I think it's changing very slowly and too slowly. I think there are many traditionally published writers who don't want to think about self-publishing. Some of them are defensive. Somehow there is still this idea that self-publishing is vanity publishing, which is at least 10 years out of date. It's weird. And I suppose that for me, I think it's an opportunity for a traditionally published author, because I have a whole backlist of books which a lot of people already have read, and that gives them some sort of social proof that some self-published writers don't have. So I have that advantage. And if most traditional published writers aren't doing that, then I suppose I have an advantage over them. But it is a weird sort of short-sightedness. Some of it's defensiveness. A lot of it is just people are more interested in writing books and thinking about marketing them, which is something I respect. But the condescension must infuriate you, and it infuriates me, and it still happens, and it shouldn't.
Yeah, well, I think what's infuriating is that people are in public quite negative, and then behind the scenes you get an email that says, "Hey, can you help me with this?"
right, yeah.
Which I think is starting
to... There is a mirror thing from some self-published quarters as well, where they, you know, a lot of thing about how all publishers are idiots. I mean, it's mostly aimed at publishers rather than traditionally published writers, but, you know, publishers are extremely intelligent people who love books and read lots of books. Publishing world is a difficult one, and I think it's much less of a problem from self-published writers, but I think some of them are too dismissive of traditional publishing, you know, dead tree publishing, all that sort of thing. There's a lot that both sides can learn from each other, and that's really what I'm trying to do, is try and get in the middle so I can figure out what works either way.
Yeah, and I think you're totally right. I mean, I certainly don't, you know, I would take a book deal if it was better than what I could do. But coming back on the marketing, because like you said, people just want to write, they don't want to do marketing. But isn't it the truth that you have to do marketing now as an author, even if you're traditionally published? Or like you said, back in the day, you went on book tours, you know, now with a publishing deal, you're expected to do podcasts and blog tours and all this other stuff, aren't you? There's no... Is anyone just writing?
Probably not. I mean, no, everyone has to do something. And I think this is another misapprehension traditionally published writers have. They think self-publishing is all about blogging and tweeting. And that's what I thought until I realized it wasn't. And that blogging and tweeting are fairly inefficient ways of going about it. But most of the marketing that they get traditionally published writers to do is blogging and tweeting. And, you know, they make you come up with... Flickr. I mean, I had to come up with a Flickr account and all these other things.
Not Instagram.
Yeah, I'm not on Instagram yet. They haven't told me to do that yet, but I'll do it if they tell me. What you guys do, which is interesting, is you measure the effectiveness very well, because you can do it on it, because it's a sort of single book. Often you do something with a single book and then you can see its effectiveness the next day. And traditional publishers haven't got that luxury. So I think a lot of marketing effort is dissipated in things that really are sort of wasting everyone's time. But as an author, you always want to show willing to your publisher, and sure, you know, you'll waste their time if necessary. I once took a Eurostar to Belgium for a book signing in a WH Smith's there, where one person showed up and then came back to London because, you know, the export department, the politics of Penguin, where the export department wanted, you know, wanted an English author to do this. So, you know, I did it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I used to work in Brussels, so I got the Eurostar to work every week, and it's okay in first class, right?
Yeah. Well, they sent me first class.
That's brilliant.
I signed one book, two people showed up, but only one of them bought a book.
Well, okay, well then I have another question, because you mentioned several times about, you know, being willing, and, you know, you're clearly a good author to work with, right? I mean, you know, and I've heard some things recently. People are like, oh, I forgot that my book was due because my contract, you know, I got the date wrong on my contract. Or, you know, the authors can be either good with publishers or not good, right? So what are your tips for, like, how do you work well with publishers so that you have a good experience?
With publishers, I think a lot of it is managing expectations. The big expectation is the contract. So it takes me 15 months to write a book. Not 12 months, but 15 months. I mean, different people are different. I'm not saying that's the right way to do it. Mm. But I will always ensure that I have 18 months in my contract to write the book. Mm. And I will negotiate that difficulty at the outset of the contract rather than in 12 months when the book's late. So that's a whatever, however long it takes you to write a book, make sure you've got enough time to do it. And publishers will, you know, if you can explain that's how you write the best book, they'll be fine with it. If, however, you miss the deadline, they won't. I think being generally professionally reliable is good. Authors have a reputation for being difficult, and that's because it is a highly emotional business. And I often feel like being extremely difficult. But I think if you can be just friendly and helpful and reliable and positive, then that helps everyone who's working with you try and sell your book. So it's a good thing to do.
Mm. And since you're, because I talk a lot about intellectual property assets on this show, and we try and keep that in mind, that this is not a book that you are just selling. This is, you know, an asset. Do you think you have that different attitude because of your financial background? Like, you know, that you understand that side of the business? Like you mentioned contracts straight away, which, to be fair, most authors don't.
Yes. I suppose so. Actually, I would say that the book business is a lot better than the financial business because the most important way to make people work together is trust and keeping your word. And in the book business, unlike the film business, but in the book business, almost everyone is trustworthy, almost most of the time, certainly compared to the financial world I come from. So I've actually really enjoyed developing relationships in the book world and developing trust and working with an editor who isn't going to, you know, screw you over unless they're really told to. I think in many ways the book world is a better business world than the financial world. You know, it's true there are things like contracts and so on, and it's always a good idea, as you were saying, to make sure that you get your rights and keep your rights, and in particular can get your rights back, which has been the difficult thing to do, because access to your ebook rights is really important if you're trying to do what we're trying to do. So that's certainly true. I suppose the other thing is just if you've worked in offices and being professional as a writer is becoming more and more important, especially if you're self-published, because there's just so much administration to do effectively and efficiently. One thing I noticed was, I don't know if this is still true, but a year or two ago, a lot of the most successful self-published writers had worked in internet marketing of some kind or other, or in marketing of some kind or other. And I can see why, you know, those skills are important.
Mm. Yeah. So coming on to marketing then, because I went and had a look at your website and, you know, your list building, which is awesome, which again, most traditionally published authors don't do list building. Amnesia was on newinbooks.com, which is the same company who do free booksy, bargain booksy. Yeah. So great. You know, they have an email list. So you're embracing these newer forms of book marketing. So, you know, how do you feel about the way things are now? And, you know, what are the tactics that you feel are working for you, or even the things that you would actually kind of enjoy?
When I thought about it, I thought there were three I needed to focus. And I think you need to focus. That's the first thing. So I decided to spend 25% of my time focusing on three things, which would be book marketing companies like BookBub, advertising, especially Facebook advertising, and list building. And so I spent a lot of time on all of that. And I think the book marketing companies have worked. Facebook advertising hasn't worked, even though I spent huge amounts of time. And I think the email lists clearly will work. I think I spent some time advertising giveaways, which probably wasn't cost effective. And obviously you don't know how much of stuff, even if something isn't working directly, you know, my financial thriller sales are steadily going up, so something's going right. So you don't know what the general brand awareness is by what you do. But I think it's important to sort of try and figure out what's working and then focus on that. One thing I do think, though, if I was doing everything I am doing now 2 years ago, I'm sure, you know, my sales would be much better. That's because there were very few people who were smart enough to be doing all that then, and I wasn't one of them. So now I get the impression that there are lots of people all trying to do the same thing. And as a result, there's a certain crowding out. So Facebook, just the cost of Facebook advertising goes up. There's more people trying to do it. I get the impression there are more people with mailing lists, which means more readers are getting many more free books, which they're not necessarily reading. So I think it's making it difficult for all of us in those three areas. You know, maybe there's Amazon advertising will work. I'm sort of about break even with that. I haven't quite got that cracked. And I find actually just a straightforward Kindle promotion works pretty well. So I haven't actually cracked. I haven't cracked this yet. You know, it's my sort of sales have doubled every year for the last 3 years, but I there's a lot more I could do, I think. And I spend a lot of time working on things which haven't quite worked. So I'm certainly not giving up, but you know, you need to figure out what's going to happen next.
Well, okay, let's be kind to ourselves, because the publishing industry hasn't figured this out either. So I think we can all relax a bit. But it's interesting with Facebook advertising. I agree with you, but in fact, probably the most powerful thing you can do with Facebook advertising is once you have an email list. So, because then you can upload your list and you can advertise to your list, but also a lookalike list. And that's actually a much faster way to build. So I think that you might, and it's much, much cheaper rather than, say, trying to go after James Patterson or Lee Child. Everyone who follows Mark Dawson now advertises to Lee Child.
Right. But I tried a lookalike list and that didn't work. But I think it was because it was mostly based on the people I signed up from the original list, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So lookalike. So if you sign up a list based on people who like Lee Child, and then you put up a lookalike list based on that, it doesn't work quite as well as it should. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And it's so interesting because the fact is this is all changing. I mean, like you said, and what's going to happen in 2 years' time is going to be completely different. But as you said about email lists, the only thing that won't change probably is email. It's pretty standard. I mean, it has been for a long, long time. So I'm hoping that will stick around. But yeah, it's great. BookBub, I just got a BookBub and it was like, whoa, that's expensive.
A BookBub, I used to get 2 years when I started this, I would get a BookBub every other time I tried because I had this, you know, backlist of books that had all sorts of quotes from big newspapers. So I stopped doing it for a bit. Then I started expecting I get, you know, BookBubs all the time. I haven't had one for 9 months.
Wow.
I think that's because big publishers are now using BookBub. So there are loads of people who have been traditionally published, not just me. So that's an example of how things have changed. But, you know, I did a very good thing with Bargain Booksy, which worked remarkably well. I was surprised how well it worked. So there are other things you can do.
Fantastic.
And as you said, if you can build your readers, if you can get the genuine readers who really like your books and want to buy every book to somehow get on your mailing list, then that's the core of what should work over the long run. And that I need to probably focus on more.
Yeah, and it must be so frustrating, you know, having had, you know, such massive earlier success where all those people should have been on your email list from have an email list for 20 years, basically.
One of the things I've tried was to get publishers to put in a proper email list and they wouldn't do it. I mean, this was many years ago I tried this. And that's kind of idiotic. I think they still don't really do it properly.
No, they don't.
Which is great, because once they start doing that properly, then everyone
then
who
screwed.
Buys lots of books, well, yeah, there'll be too many emails around, so we don't want that to happen.
No, and then, you know, just coming back to the brand thing, because this is the other thing I was thinking about. As a reader, I'm sure you're the same, like there are only a handful of authors that you buy every book, right?
Yeah.
So, and you don't really even question that. And that kind of loyalty takes time to build up.
Yeah.
So, and that's when I looked at your reviews. It was really interesting because there are clearly people who've been following you who were writing reviews on Amnesia, for example, who've been following you for 20 years.
Yes, yeah.
That's awesome.
I did a lot of email. I mean, I had my own sort of emailing list, which was basically a file in my Outlook, which is just everyone who ever sent me an email. And that built up over time. So that was a good way of sort of always getting a small kickstart. But obviously, there are all these ways now of being much more analytical and efficient about gathering emails. But there's a woman called Susan who's just come back from Iceland, who I think first wrote to me 15 years ago, you know, who's been to Iceland for the first time. And you do recognize these names and just get to know them over time. It's lovely. I mean, essentially, when we write books, we write them for readers. And when these readers have real names and you get to know them and they're reading your books and genuinely enjoying them, it's sort of what it's all about, really.
I think so. And I keep coming back to that. You know, there are people listening, hello listeners, who've been listening since 2009. And right. That's kind of crazy, right? And now they're getting to know you because you came on the show. And that kind of loyalty over time is what I think we're looking for. And maybe there is no shortcut, you know, we can only cast a net wide and see what happens. But last question, because we're almost out of time. You're really active in the UK crime writing scene, the CWA, the Crime Writers Association, and you go to Crime Fest and Harrogate and all these different things. So how important is networking in person for your author business, but also your morale and happiness?
Well, I think it's very clever of you to put that into two questions, because it's good from the author's point of view, especially if you're traditionally published, because it's really hard to have direct contact with readers. But if you know people who can influence readers, then that's great. And so if you're known within your community, you're more likely that if a reviewer or a publisher at another company sees your book, they'll know who you are and they'll be more likely to look at it for 20 seconds and then perhaps read the whole thing. So that's definitely a good idea. But the morale thing is really true too, because I've had sort of up, down, and hopefully up again in my career. And on the downs, it's good to know people who are in the same position as you. Either they're suffering like you are, or they're people you really respect, who respect you because of the kind of books you've written. And that's what keeps you going through the sort of difficult periods of over, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. And when I see friends of mine who are in the situation we described earlier, who maybe have lost their publisher or don't know what, you know, are feeling down, then I do my best to help them, because I was there in the past. I'll probably be there in the future, and we can all help each other. So writing can be a very lonely occupation, obviously, and anything you can do to improve that is a very good idea, I think.
Fantastic. Right. So where can people find you and all your books online?
Well, I have a website, michaelridpath.com, and obviously I'm on Amazon all over the world. So just look up Michael Ridpath on amazon.co.uk or .com, and I should be there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Michael. That was great.
Thanks, Joanna.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Michael Ridpath, and you can find his books wherever books are sold. Next week, I'm talking to Roz Morris about writing memoir. Roz has been on the show a number of times. She's always a popular guest. And this time we're talking about her latest book, Not Quite Lost, which is a quirky little memoir that I like a lot and will actually use as a model for my own when I finally get round to a book like that. It's something I've been thinking about for years, and Roz's sort of layout has been something that I've been thinking about. So looking forward to that. Happy writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.